Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. We're talking, of course, about the Billy Meier case tonight. But just a word, I do think my life is somewhat coming back to normal, so we can probably schedule some guests here shortly, at least I'm hoping. Edward Albert Meier is a 80-year-old man who lives in Switzerland, in northern Switzerland, in a tiny mountain village called Hinterschmidruti, which is about 45 minutes to an hour east of Zurich, nestled in the mountains and the pine forest there in northern Switzerland. Billy's quite an author. He's written over 40 books. I've heard it said he's written over 50, in fact. He has written 2,000 contact reports and hundreds of other bulletins. He's quite a prolific writer. His life has been very unusual. If you go back to when he was 6 months old, he was growing up in even farther north in Switzerland, an area called Bulac, near a town called Niederflach. And when he was 6 months old, he was in a coma from a very bad pneumonia, and he was near death. The doctors thought he wouldn't make it through the evening, and something happened very amazing. A extraterrestrial man by the name of Sloth used some kind of technical device to heal Billy. So Billy didn't pass away, and it's a good thing too, because the world would have certainly missed him a great deal. He, at about 5 years old or so, he started getting telepathic messages from this man named Sloth, and he was told to go out near his home into the forest and wait for Sloth to come. Sloth was an extraterrestrial human being who was from a race of extraterrestrials that live some 80 light years beyond our Pleiades in a different space-time configuration. In any case, Sloth landed his ship near the site that Billy was told to go, but he didn't meet Billy that time. He didn't come out of the ship. Instead, the ship sat there for a while and then left, and so young Edward wouldn't get to meet Sloth until about, I think it was a couple years later, that the strange silvery pear-shaped craft came down to the ground again, landed, outstepped Sloth in his diver suit, and Billy was lifted up as if by ghostly hands into the ship, and the two went up some 71 meters in the air, and Sloth started to teach Billy. He was going to be Billy's mentor for the next 11 years. And he told Billy first about his previous lives, that he had been the people that we call today Enoch, Elijah, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Emmanuel, and Muhammad. And that in each one of these lifetimes, when he was a prophet and a teacher, he taught the creational natural laws, the laws of the universe, and related spiritual teachings. Now, Sloth and his people were aware that Billy's spirit form had been incarnating on the earth for the past 13,000 years. So they had the technology to track spirit forms. What they didn't realize at the time is that Edward Albert Meyer's spirit form was extremely ancient, and that he had not only lived lives on the earth, but he had lived in other galaxies stretching many, many billions of years back. In fact, they would later learn that Billy, his spiritual consciousness had incarnated as their spiritual teacher, and a man called Nicodemus. So Sfaf, who was Billy's mentor, realized that eventually Edward would know much more than him and be this fantastic teacher. And later, Billy's other contacts learned a more complete spiritual lineage about who he had been in the past, going back some 9.6 billion years. And some of the other personalities of Edward Albert Meyer include Aristotle, Socrates, Mendelssohn, Mozart, Galileo, Rasputin, Nicodemus, who was the teacher of the Pleiaron. He's also been the four people that we call Henoch. And one of his incarnations, he was known as Semyase, who is talked about in Contact Report 9. So Edward Albert Meyer's spiritual consciousness is very ancient. And Sfaf, this extraterrestrial man of nearly 1,000 years old, had come to the earth to ensure that this young boy would get a proper upbringing and a proper education so that his mission on this earth would be successful. His mission to teach the spiritual teachings again, to teach the creational natural laws, which we'll talk about again tonight. In any case, Sfaf told Billy that he would have a difficult life. He was told to stay in the background, that other people would come forward to tell his story. He was told about his wife leaving him. He was told he would lose his left arm. He was told many things. He was told people would try to kill him. There would be many attempts on his life. But he knew also that he would be having access and to great, incredible amounts of information. So he did accept this mission during this lifetime. He had the option to turn against it and to not do it. But for our sakes, I'm glad he did. So Sfaf met with Billy for the next 11 years. One year he met with Billy well over 100 times. Billy missed many days at school. His father would punish him very severely, and Billy sometimes could neither sit nor stand after these punishments. But the punishment was effective in helped build Billy's perseverance and his character, because Billy would have to endure many challenges and many, many different difficult things in his life over the years. Billy was told about the coming time, which is called the third millennium. He was told that the United States would drop atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It was explained to him that this would be a great time of confusion and transition, confusion and maliciousness. Later, Billy would start his own writings when he was much, much older, and Sfaf prepared Billy for this by teaching him spiritual telepathy, which enabled Billy to pull information down from a spiritual plane called Arahat Athrasata. Billy's real name is Edward Albert Meyer. His nickname is Billy. He often goes by the acronym BEAM, B-E-A-M. And it's interesting that a beam is a light. In many ways, the teachings of Edward Albert Meyer are a light to people that are very much in the darkness, because the people on the earth are an insane society and we're rushing headlong to our own destruction, but we don't realize it yet. We do not understand completely the danger that we are in. So after meeting with Billy for 11 years until Billy was about 16 years old, Billy was told by Sfaf he would get his new teacher. By the way, Sfaf's people are not from the Pleiades. They live in a different space-time configuration, some 80 light years beyond our Pleiades. And they call themselves the Pleiaren, although they've allowed themselves to be called the Pleiadians for many years. They knew that there would come a time when it would be easy for people to understand the demarcation between those that had real contacts and those who had real information. And the real information is related to these people called the Pleiaren. And they have told us that their forefathers are our forefathers. And our forefathers are a race of titans. I like to call them titans because they had such powerful material consciousnesses. These people were from Lyra Vega and Lyrians, and they learned the powers of the human spirit and the ability of the human spirit to do amazing things like teleportation, telekinesis, amazing things to affect physical reality with your thoughts. These people were very advanced. Some of them became tyrants, and that itself is something we can talk about in a while, but I wanted to get back to Billy's second teacher, whose people are called the Timmers, who also descended from the Lyrians. Now, the Timmers now reside in a parallel universe to ours. We have a universe that was created 46 trillion years ago, and a sister universe was created called the Tao universe. And the Timmers are from the Tao universe now. They originally came out of the Milky Way galaxy. They were descendants of the Lyrians. Askit sent for Billy a robotic. She sent Billy a robotic craft right around, I think it was 1953. Billy was told to go up on a hill very close to his home and wait. And it was a cold evening in Switzerland. And in the contact report, it mentions that Billy had broke a sweat, even though it was a very cold evening. And Billy went up to on top of a hill where he often sat and meditated and thought about things and considered various things going on in the world. And then he noticed this craft coming down. It was getting close to night. And it was a very strange craft with a strange kind of tripod circular structure on the bottom of the craft. And it landed nearby, and the hatch opened, and Billy could see there was no one in there and just a seat. So he was literally kind of lifted up into the ship, again as if by ghostly hands, the same kind of thing he experienced with Svath. He sat down in the seat, and then there was a bright flash of light. He held up his hands to protect his eyes, but the ship became invisible. He became invisible, and he could see that he was inside the ship. He could still feel himself seated. He could feel his feet on the floor, but he could see that he was rising up from the top of this hill, slowly moving in the direction of the village where he lived. And then the craft hovered just a few meters above the house he was living in this village in Switzerland. And then it took off with great speed and went high into the night sky. And Billy got to see this shining stars in a way that he had never seen them before. And he saw the golden disk of the sun. He was so high, he could see the sun in space. And he looked back down and he could see the Indian Ocean. And it was a beautiful scene. Eventually, the ship landed in an area called Jordan, and there were red rocks and there were a red sand. He could feel the heat coming off these rocks. And then he noticed another craft approaching, but it was looking first like a falling star that came slowly, and then it got larger and larger. And he could see a 300-foot disk as it came to a near stop in the sky, and then slowly, slowly moved down toward the ground and landed on its tripod gear. And Billy had to wait for half an hour. And then out stepped this woman who would be his mentor for the next 11 years. She was a very beautiful woman. She wore some strange garb that almost looked like a coverall with just a small little kind of dress thing. And he thought she looked like a, what he called a modern angel. But he also felt that he knew her, but he didn't know why. In any case, they both got into her ship and they traveled towards the Great Pyramid. Askett's ship was cloaked. It landed near what Billy calls the strange statue of the animal human. He calls it, he refers to it something like that, the Sphinx. Her ship was cloaked. Billy and her got out. She put these devices on them, which made them invisible except to each other. And Billy played some pranks on some Bedouin women, some near women there that were staying in tents. Billy stole some kisses from them, and it's really a bit of a side story. It doesn't really have much to do with this particular adventure that he's on. But Askett and him walk over to the Giza Plateau, and there is a entrance into these old cubicle constructions. It goes down underground for many, many thousands of feet. These cubicle constructions are some 73,000 years old, and they travel for some quite of a long time in this very, very dark tunnel-like thing far underground until they come to what looks like a wall with a gigantic granite stone that they call an ashlar. And then using some kind of technology, Askett literally dissolves this gigantic stone. Then they continue to walk and the stone reforms behind them. And Billy can see this gigantic hallway where the light seems to come from everywhere and yet nowhere. He also notices a very large ancient spacecraft, smaller craft, strangely dressed guards, and then there's kind of a platform to his right. On that platform, he sees a cross. He sees a crown of thorns, blood-encrusted nails, and a leather pouch with what look like very valuable stones in it. And he's very kind of shocked by all this. He has a kind of a Protestant background, and he isn't sure what to make of this. And Askett and him leave, and they retrace their path through the tunnel system and back up to the surface. And Billy and Askett then talk for the longest time. And she tells him that there was a splinter group, a renegade group, kind of a criminal slash terrorist group that split off from Sfas people, the Plaiaran. And they kind of organized themselves in an attempt to control the people of the earth using religion and other related technology. They eventually ended up far below the Great Pyramid, but they can be traced all the way back, their lineage, to a guy named Eris the Barbarian, who got the great war started between Atlantis and Lemuria. His descendant, Eris the 11th, I think returned to the earth after the great cataclysm. The cataclysm that I'm referring to occurred 11,500 years ago when people from the city of Mu brought an asteroid from the asteroid belt and used it as a weapon against the people of Atlantis and nearly destroyed the earth. They knocked the earth off its axis, about just killed every living thing on the earth, and threw what little civilization survived back to the Stone Age. That left the people of the earth very vulnerable. And then people came here, and I believe they came from Beta Centauri. And there was, I believe the lineage goes something like, there was a man named Eris the 11th, who had a son, Jehovan, who had a son named Jehave. And then Jehave, I believe, had a son named Erisame. Erisame was the one that went underground. And he formed his group there called the Giza Intelligences. Now, typically, the son would kill the father. They were very brutal. They also demanded worship from the people of Earth, who were just, again, they forgot who they were. They lost their technology. They were barely surviving. They were extremely vulnerable. And they were manipulated by these extraterrestrials, starting with Erisame. Now, Erisame, interestingly, was the beginning of this whole group officially. That, and these people were here, according to Meyer information, until the middle 1970s. But another very well-known person from this Giza Intelligences, according to Meyer information, and I know this is very offensive to some people, but the person called Jehovah from the Old Testament, was, according to Meyer information, was not the creator of the universe. He was one of these extraterrestrials that was using religion to try to control the people of the earth. And he did quite a good job. He was called God by the Hebrons, the Hebrons, as the Meyer information calls them. Jehovah was also known as Hen or the Cruel One. He destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, not with mystical God powers, but with nuclear weapons. And in conjunction with that, there was a meteor and an earthquake in the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, the other noteworthy thing that happened with the Giza Intelligences is occurred probably during the lifetime of Comegall II, who was also one of these leaders. After Jehovah took power away from, I believe it was Erisame. Comegall I took over after Jehovah, and then Comegall II took over from Comegall I. Comegall II influenced the Thule Society in Germany, and in turn influenced Hitler. Also through an individual in the Thule Society named Hermann Steinschneider, who was known as Erik Janusson at the time. And he influenced Hitler and kind of pushed him into the road, pushed him into the path of megalomania. Otherwise, Hitler would have been a very beneficial leader to the earth. In fact, he was impulsed by the Plejaren themselves. They impulsed Hitler to be a very good leader for the people of the earth. However, these Giza Intelligences eventually pushed Hitler into megalomania, and then we know what happened in World War II. Askett taught Billy much about these Giza Intelligences. She also allegedly took Billy on a time travel trip back to the time of the person called Emmanuel. Now, this was a particular area of the Meyer material that I just thought, I don't know, I just didn't know what to think of it. It didn't really seem to jive with my understanding. I mean, how in the world could we be wrong about the central figure of Western society? And then I did a little more research, and I was astounded, first of all, to determine that there was no letter J in the ancient world. Not in the Hebrew, not in the Greek, not in the Aramaic, so none of the languages of the Bible had a letter J. Not English, not French, not German. No J sound in the ancient world. No letter J till about 1550 at the earliest. So, all the names that you see in the New Testament and the Old Testament that contain the letter J were different when the Bible first was written. James and John have names which are pretty much unpronounceable for most Western people. Both of those names began with a Y. And often, what they did was substitute the new letter J, once the letter J was invented around 1550, by a guy named Gian Giorgio Turrisino, who was an Italian playwright and scholar, invented the letter J as kind of a replacement, for whatever reason, with the letter I and the letter Y. So the original book of Job was the book of Iob. The name, for example, of Elijah was Eliah. The names like John and James began with a Y and are almost unpronounceable, like I said. Also, names, for example, if you look at this 1611 version of the King James, it'll say Our Lord and Savior, I-E-S-V-S. Not Our Lord and Savior Jesus. So he wasn't called Jesus originally. Not until later, probably around the middle 1600s, that he started getting called Jesus. And it was, there are various different notions about that. If you look at the Italian Renaissance, let's step back in time, say from about 1300 to about 1550 or about 1600, you'll notice that there was often at the top of the crucifixion the acronym INRI. And that was the Latin, which said Iesus is what he was called in the Latin, Iesus Nazarenus Rex Iodorium. So art proves the point that he wasn't called Jesus originally. That came later. Some say he was called Jesus, some say Yeshua, some say Iesus. There are different opinions, but he certainly wasn't called Jesus. Now, let me quote two passages. One passage from Matthew chapter 1, I think it's verse 7 or verse 23. I'd have to double check. It says, his name will be called Emmanuel. And it also says the same thing in the book of Isaiah. I think it's chapter 7, verse 14. His name will be called Emmanuel. Now, religion today says, oh, that was just a title. That wasn't his name, even though it's translated. His name will be called Emmanuel. It doesn't say his title will be called Emmanuel. It says his name will be called Emmanuel. So this was the turning point for me when I discovered this history. So the story of Emmanuel as one of this part of the spiritual lineage of Billy Meyer is not so amazing to me anymore, not so strange. So take that and evaluate it yourself. I don't try to push the Meyer information on anyone. I just tell them it's very important information to consider. Let me talk quickly about disclosure, because I think we've already had the first disclosure, the introductory disclosure. We haven't had any government official come out, and I think that's good because the governments of the world are so corrupt and so unreliable. Why would we need the governments of the world to tell us what the truth is? I mean, they've never told us the truth, right? So, who has told us the truth? Well, we've had a lot of insiders come forward, like Sergeant Clifford Stone from the Air Force, who was part of the crash retrieval team. He was part of a team that would go to landing sites and try to interface with these extraterrestrials. Clifford had some kind of empathic or telepathic ability, and he could at times communicate with them. Another man who's come forward was Sergeant Robert Dean, O'Dean, who worked at SHAPE headquarters, Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers Europe, and he got to see the documents. In fact, one of the generals told him to read this particular document since he had the clearance for it anyway. And it told about six races that were interacting with the people of the Earth at that time. Two of them looked so identical to us. You just couldn't tell Earth humans and them apart. They look exactly the same. Another important insider has been Colonel Philip Corso, who wrote the book The Day After Roswell, told about the back engineering of the craft from Roswell. And then one very important disclosure person that I think isn't given nearly enough attention is Dr. Hermann Oberth, a German scientist who said openly in a meeting in the 1970s, and this has been recorded, you can listen to it on YouTube, Dr. Hermann Oberth said, "The people of Germany cannot take credit for their technological advances alone because they had been helped by people of other worlds." And then he went on to talk about gravity and how these ships somehow had conquered gravity. And he talked about cylindrical-shaped ships and disc-shaped ships. And I think is one of the important aspects of disclosure. And then, of course, Colonel Wendell Stevens, who wrote a couple books on the Meyer case and who did the original investigation of the Meyer case and all the gathering of other information about other contactees like Stephen DiNardo and others, and Colonel Donald Ware I've had on the show. The list goes on and on and on, many of them. So we've already had disclosure, folks. We don't need some corrupt, incompetent government official to come and tell us what we should think. We shouldn't be dependent thinkers anymore. Dependent thinkers need mom and dad to tell them what to think. And that's the unfortunate problem that we have and the unfortunate place that we still are, like children, looking to our authority figures to tell us what the truth is, despite all the information that's already out there. We need to be able to think for ourselves. We need to be independent thinkers. And it's one of the important things that the Meyer information teaches us, is not to be submissive and not to be dependent thinkers. Our thoughts have tremendous power. And Billy has dedicated a whole book to this concept. It's called The Might of the Thoughts. You are the master of your own destiny. The circumstances of your life come from your thoughts. Good thoughts lead to good feelings. Good feelings lead to good habits. Good habits lead to good circumstances in your life. Let me read something here that's said in The Might of Thoughts. "A weak human being can never be helped if he/she does not allow him or herself to be helped and does not want to recognize and accept the truth of the might of the thoughts. Thus, stronger or even very strong human beings are in fact only able to help a weaker human being when the human being grasps the helping hand stretched out to him. Yet it is not done with that alone, because truthfully, the weak one must become strong himself, herself, and pull himself up in order to make a positive step, so that improvement and strength, which maneuver him or her out of her misery and can take hold of him or her." The might of our thoughts are incredible, and the Meyer spiritual teachings are about us learning the might of our own thoughts. Every human who does not overcome his weaknesses and free himself from his unproductive thoughts will remain wretched, weak, and miserable. Every human attracts and brings into fruition that which he secretly or overtly desires and wants. Your thoughts bring reality into your life. The improvement in strength must be developed as a result of one's own efforts. We are responsible for our own lives. We are responsible for the circumstances of our life. And we create a lot of circumstances in our life and we don't realize we're doing it. So it's so important to evaluate our life. So Billy met with Spoth for 11 years. He met with Askit for 11 years. Then he had 11 years of no contacts. During that time, he married a Greek woman named Calliope. He moved back to Switzerland. And he did a lot of studying on his own. You see, Spoth had taught him to use spiritual telepathy, as I mentioned earlier. And that gave him the ability to pull information down from a spiritual plane called Arahat Athrasata. And Billy was also very sensitive to the what's called the universal storage banks, which has incredible amounts of information in it. So he was amassing tremendous amounts of information and starting to write some of this information down. When Billy, I believe, was about 38 years old, roughly in the middle of 1970s, I'm guesstimating a little bit here, he got his first telepathic messages from another Plejaran woman named Semyase, who would land her beam ship in clearings near the wooded areas in Switzerland, and Billy would come to the landing site with his moped, and they would both sit down, often under trees, and she would give him these incredible bits of information, either about the spiritual teachings or about Earth history, or about mundane things every once in a while, but mostly about very fascinating topics. Billy would go home after the meeting, and the ship would transmit to him mentally in telepathic symbols the exact verbatim conversation, and Billy would write it down as quickly as possible using his computer. Now, these contacts went on until about 1984. They were broken off for a while because Semyase was involved in an accident. By this time, Billy had created a building called the Semyase Silver Star Center, where sometimes Semyase would beam in, so to speak, into certain rooms and have conversations with Billy. Well, one of the other people working at the building there, a guy named Jacobus, came in and surprised Semyase. Well, these extraterrestrials at this level of evolution are very sensitive to our thought forms, to our thought vibrations, and our thought vibrations are very, very damaging to them and unhealthy because we're at a very young stage and our thoughts still have great might, but they're not neutral, positive, they're not healthy, they're not good. And these very advanced extraterrestrials read thoughts, they feel thoughts, and it throws their whole system off to be around an Earth human because our evolvement is so low. So she fell. They often lose control of their bodies when they come. They typically wear some kind of technology to protect them. But she fell. She hit her head. She managed to beam herself back to her ship, but she lost consciousness. By the time she was found, she had to be rushed for medical attention. And so Billy didn't have any contacts with her for months. Eventually, she came back and resumed the contacts, but But she had a relapse in about 1984, and she had to be taken to the Tao universe to work with a group of ETs called the Sonar, S-O-N-A-E-R, as they have the ability to travel without ships with their minds, teleportation or something. And they also have great knowledge in terms of the medical field. And they worked to help heal Sannyasi. She's still there. She'll require therapy, I think, for the next 70 years. So these extraterrestrials come here at great risk for themselves. And what we're in now is the second stage of disclosure, where the information is getting out to humanity slowly, primarily through the Meyer case, I believe. The information is getting out into our society to set the groundwork for the transition of our society from a society that's living in a way that's not sustainable, a society that's destroying itself, to a society that has a great future. And this will come slowly over the next 800 years or so. I want to say hi to Nathan for joining me, Nate Mallow. It's good to see him in the chat room. But there are certain creational natural laws that we're going to learn about in the next 800 years, one of which is the law of love. And the law of love is the highest principle in creation. No, we're not talking about artificial love, not talking about romantic love, which often leads to anger and discord and instability and unhappiness. We're talking about a very stable love that's based on reverence. And there's some beautiful passages about what Billy particularly has written about love. And these are passages which I think will affect your subconscious as much as your conscious mind. Because, you know, words are vehicles for ideas and thoughts. And the ideas are so high in this Meyer information about love. It's very difficult, I think, to put them into words. But I think Billy has very masterfully done this and used these words that contain these concepts. And if you'll meditate on these words, they will change your whole level of awareness. One of the things that Billy's written is that love is the highest principle in all creation. And through it, everything exists in absolute logic. Every tiny plant and every tiny animal fulfills its purpose in love. The incredible splendor of nature is the visible expression of the love of creation, and creation radiates love. In fact, nothing that exists would exist if it were not for the radiating love of creation. Sannyasi told Billy that love and wisdom go together, and the creation and its laws are love and wisdom at the same time. When Billy was a very small boy, growing up in Niederflachs in Bulak in North Switzerland, he woke up one evening and looked up at a beautiful starry sky. And he started talking about the love of creation. He said, "My eyes saw the light which the stars emitted, but I realized there was another light, an invisible light he called the love of creation. And he heard his own voice say, 'Since ancient times I lived among the stars.' And he knew at that point what his purpose of his life was." There's another passage in the Goblet of Truth that's entitled, "What the Truth Knows to Say." And it, to me, talks about this whole idea of the creation and its love, but in slightly different terms. It says rivers, stones, plants, bushes, trees, everything that crawls and flies on the earth is a life form with a spirit form. And these beings are on a journey through time, which involves many, many lifetimes. And these creatures are aware of each other, and they're connected by psychic swinging waves, some of the earlier translations say. So if you look at the birds and they turn on a dime as a single entity, these are because they're all connected. And one of the things that we have to learn is that we as creation are all connected in a way that we will start to understand more in the future. But love is the highest principle. We're talking about an effective love, not an affective or romantic love. And this is the highest principle in creation. This will raise your consciousness, awareness higher than anything. But it's a difficult thing to put into words because the ideas are greater than the words. For example, creation, the universal consciousness, is more like the water of the ocean or the clouds in the sky or the rocks in the mountains. It has a new personality, yet it has an incredible love. It literally radiates love. And as you grow spiritually, you will develop in your spiritual consciousness something called empfinding, which will be a fine sensitive feeling which will start to pick up on that radiating love of creation. So we are in the second stage of disclosure, which is the raising of the level of humanity, the level of our awareness, which is going to increase our awareness. More than anything, what's going to help you in your daily life is the information that I've talked about in a book. It's called The Might of Thoughts. And as I'm running out of time here, one of the things I wanted to bring up is you have an inner nature. The real you is called the inner nature. It's your innermost creational nature. It threatens the artificial or false you, the temporary personality that opposes a lot of times your spiritual growth, because you have an artificial I, let's call it that for lack of a better word, that knows it's threatened by the inner I. Let me read this passage from the Maya Thoughts. To build up one's own inner nature in line with the creation nature, and to do it progressively as well as neutral, positive, equalized, and to in fact also then to know this nature and live true to its constitution actually means living. And it is also certain that whoever has built up his/her inner nature with the impulses of the creational nature has caused it to blossom and can love himself or herself in all honesty and deference without thereby falling into negative, bad states. But connected with it is knowing oneself. Consequently, the effective facts of the newly formed and creationally directed inner nature must therefore be recognized and accepted before a practical and respectable love can come about for it. So you have a true inner nature. It's the real you, and that's related to your spirit form. Everyone has within them a tiny fragment of the universal consciousness. It's not actually a fragment, but operationally you can think of it as a fragment of the universal consciousness. It comes into the body of a child 21 days after the sperm fertilizes the egg, and it sends the spiritual energy throughout the body. It causes the heart to beat, and it causes the consciousness to think. It brings in with it from the spiritual realm the consciousness. What I'm talking about is the material consciousness. Your material consciousness is actually created in the spirit realm. And one thing that's programmed into your subconscious is the last level of spiritual evolvement that you were at. So all of the evolutive values that you achieved in your previous life, like love and wisdom and honesty and fairness and logic and discernment, all of those are programmed into the subconscious. So your previous level of evolution is stored in your subconscious. So the new consciousness, particularly the conscious mind, as it grows up again, it's a child, remember, will be impulsed from the subconscious. And slowly, slowly, the conscious mind starts to recognize these impulses and learns to trust them and starts to follow them more and more and more as he gets older. And he starts to advance in his evolution because he's trusting these inner impulses that he's getting. And these inner impulses sometimes will go very contrary to civilization. Civilization is giving us false information and false impulses all the time. Particularly, I believe, my personal opinion, is if you're exposed in a highly overpopulated area, you're getting impulses all the time, which are bombarding your consciousness with things that are generally unhealthy, thoughts that are not, I want to say not your own, but I guess we have to have responsibility. So you need to focus on the information in the Meyer teachings, like everyone does, in order to kind of remain separated. Let me read this, what it says here. How if the human being remains separated, in this case, what happens is, if you're influenced by the civilization today, you will be separated from your inner self, from your inner nature. However, if the human remains separated from himself or herself by disregarding his inner nature and not forming it such that it conforms to the creational laws and recommendations, then he or she separates himself, so to speak, from his own life, because as a result of not developing himself or herself higher, he and she distances himself from real life. That is to say, from his own real self, which is embodied by the inner nature and from which the factor of the actual personality comes forth. And if by means of his or her own will, the human being lives apart from his/her real self, apart from the actual inner nature, which the human being must himself or herself develop creationally, then in fact, one cannot say that in the case the inner self can be positively given full expression. Because with this self, one is truthfully dealing. Okay, there's two selves. There's the real inner nature that's influenced by the spirit, and then there's a fake self. Let me say it right here. I'll read it. It's truthfully only dealing with a fake self, or an ersatz self. I guess that's a German term, which the human being himself or herself is responsible for acquiring, and which is only imprinted according to that which is short-lived, not idealized, ideas created and expressed, which also cannot be realized. The unnatural state, which works against the creational natural impulses and laws, no human being can be satisfied in the long term. So, if you listen to the impulses from your spirit form, you will develop your real self. If you do not pay attention to the impulses coming from your spiritual consciousness, you will develop this fake self. The fake self, in the long term, becomes unsatisfied and gets out of alignment in some form, which naturally brings him or her inequity and harm. So many people that damage themselves are doing so because they're not under the influence of their real inner nature. They're being pushed by this fake self. That the human being then no longer even likes himself. So people go into this self-loathing. And an unavoidable consequence, however, this not liking oneself anymore does not concern the material body, rather it concerns the self-created, unnatural inner nature. That is, so to say, the inner self. This is on page 290 of my version of the Mind of Thoughts. Once the human being goes into his innermost creational self and forms his inner nature, his or her actual self, and thereby also his or her effective personality according to the impulses of his or her innermost self and striving urge. You see, we're getting these urges for striving. You know, when we talk about striving is like a second creational natural law. This impulse to evolve is very, very important. It's related to your happiness. Without striving, there's no sense of life. There's no happiness. So this striving urge, then he or she becomes a human being who is really living according to the creation. And he or she becomes one with the creational power, which he or she can then utilize because he or she is able to create it himself. So if you follow these impulses, you will be able to have this power with you to deal with many, many things. Also connected with knowing oneself and liking oneself is the factor of self-respect. And it is very essential for a human being for them to have self-respect. And self-respect is extremely important. A couple of the things, I'm running out of time, so I want to tell yourself, I have confidence. I am optimistic. I am relaxed. I am cheerful. I am enthusiastic. These concepts are in this book. And these ideas, I'm confident, I'm optimistic, I'm relaxed, I'm cheerful, these will turn around your negative and unproductive thoughts, which are at war with your inner nature. I hope you have a great rest of the week. You've been listening to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.